This is a Dauntless Media Collective podcast. Visit dauntless.fm for more content.
Then I think she endures verbal abuse for a season, and she endures perhaps being smacked one night, and then she seeks help from the church.
There is a pile of dead bodies behind the Mars Hill bus, and by God's grace, it'll be a mountain by the time we're done. You either get on the bus or you get run over by the bus. Those are the options.
There's nothing holy about writing discrimination into the law, and I am tired of communities of faith being weaponized because the only time religious freedom is invoked is in the name of bigotry and discrimination. I'm tired of it.
Hi, I'm Nate, producer and co-host on the Full Mutuality podcast. Let's talk about inequality. It's everywhere. Whether it's rooted in race, gender, ability, or sexuality, there's bound to be an imbalance in power, influence, representation, and access. On our show, we want to explore areas of religion, culture, and society where justice is needed in order to bring about true mutuality. I hope you'll join us for some enlightening, fun, and at times uncomfortable conversations as we envision a world where everyone can live free from systems and structures that keep us from being truly equal. You can find us on your favorite podcast app or visit our website, fullmutuality.com, to find a list of all the platforms we're available on. Subscribe today, and we'll see you on the Full Mutuality Podcast.
I regret to inform you, you're on Chapel Probation, a podcast that takes a critical look at evangelical colleges and universities, particularly Azusa Pacific University, where I taught English for 15 years. I'm Scott Okamoto, and I'm writing a book about my experience deconstructing all the way to agnostic atheism while teaching at APU. Greetings, reprobates. That's what I'm calling listeners and supporters of this podcast. Trying it out. I don't know. What do you think? Interesting fact, the secondary definition of reprobate is an old Calvinist term to point out those who are not getting into heaven as preordained by God. There is some potential there, for sure. You goddamn reprobates. As we wrap up this first season, I want to thank all the guests who have come on, including today's guest, Amy Scott. Going back through the experience, which both shaped us and damaged us, is not easy. I'm not great at math, but I'd say 67 to 73% of the guests have had to do their interviews with multiple drinks or edibles. The others just prayed to Satan or Cthulhu for peace of mind. No names, but some did both. I'm now focusing on writing my book, which will be published by Lake Drive Books, hopefully in December of this year or January of next year, and I'm excited to get back to telling my story. I'll be back here on Chapel Probation for Season 2, after July sometime. I have a few more APU folks who I wanted to get into this first season, but I ran out of time. I now have a deadline to meet for my book, so we'll get to you in the second season. And I want to open it up to other people who went to other Christian schools, and I've already been messaged by a few who have some pretty wild stories that they experienced. So, yeah, we will see you back in Season 2. Last week, Glenda walked us through the peak years of Haven as its own group that could determine its own destiny before the school took over and basically killed it. Amy Scott came to APU almost 10 years before all that went down. They had big plans to be a Bible translator and bring the good news of Jesus to the world. But life experiences both inside and outside of APU opened up doors for experience they never knew existed. Ironically, the door of discussion at APU, a supposedly uncensored free speech area on the campus, would play a central role in Amy's experience and development.
Hi, I'm Amy Scott. I'm a commercial food and lifestyle photographer. I went to APU from 2004 to 2007, and I was a global studies major. I use they, them pronouns, and I identify as non-binary and queer, and I currently live in Texas. So When I went to APU in spring 2004, I was already a bit of a questioning Christian. I identified as a woman at the time, and I identified as straight at the time, or rather just hadn't looked at those things ever, so had no idea that something else might be true. And I had transferred in from a local community college. So I had tried to get into Wheaton a couple of times. So I was really sort of interested in going there. My background is that my parents were missionaries, and so was raised in a really religious household. I had come to that religion and sort of took it as my own in high school, and so got really into the idea of like, I'm gonna, you know, translate Bibles for people. And so that's why I was really excited about Wheaton and didn't get in. So I ended up spending a year at a community college in their honors program. And that was sort of the beginning of the unraveling, because it, one, wasn't a Christian environment. So I got to ask a lot of the questions that I hadn't been allowed to yet. So I took like philosophy classes and sociology classes and started having conversations that I was really interested in. And that hadn't, there hadn't been space for that in Christian environments. Yeah. So here I am like writing papers about the ethics of pornography and like rape culture in the US. And then I don't get into Wheaton again. And so my parents just say, I have to go to APU. It's the only other place I had applied to. And they're like, we got to get you out of this house. We don't want you to keep going at the community college, even though you enjoy it. So then I'm just dumped into APU at that point, like disappointed I didn't get into the school I wanted to be at, already asking a lot of questions and having conversations that were not welcome in APU.
Yeah.
And you know, I wasn't really ready to fit in. I know that transfer students already have difficulty with that. But, you know, coming in, I just sort of didn't know what to do with the culture of APU. I was already kind of asking, like I said, like looking at the faith more critically. And I was like, oh, no, all these people in Ugg boots and skirts and stuff, like this just wasn't who I was.
Yeah. Yeah. So the church culture that you came from was not similar to APU's sort of, you know, bright, shiny evangelical culture.
I would say that it was relatively in line with it. So they had been missionaries in Japan for like 5 years. That's where they met and got married. And that was like a huge part of their story, was their belief system. Yeah. So they had like shifted around from between churches as I grew up, but it was all like very evangelical. You have to like spread the word. And you know, even if they're okay with drums and electric guitars, that was about like as open as they were.
That's far left in the evangelical. Okay, so you get to APU and you're a transfer student. Did you find a group of people to get to be involved with, or was it just like a struggle to find your people?
I got lucky in that I actually got plugged in. The place I lived was like the international student area. It was like in the mods.
Oh, right.
So I got to hang out with a bunch of cool like international Chinese students, and they were really welcoming to me. Like we were just like kind of the outsiders. So I hung out with them my first semester and like did all of the like multicultural events. And that was sort of more of a place where I connected than sort of the Southern California girly girl conversation. So I did that for a semester and just really like, I was kind of a loner and hung out with sort of at the like multicultural student center a little bit. And then I went straight to, since I was a global studies major, I went straight to LA term. So that was a bit of whiplash to immediately then, you know, leave APU campus, drop into LA term. And what that meant for people who don't know is you live, well, it no longer exists, but I lived with a non-Christian human, a wonderful Indian woman, and I had an internship at AIDS Project Los Angeles, and I took classes with actually Dan Hodge, who you've interviewed. And so it just got me to continue on that track of, you know, spending time with people who were not Christians, who were incredible humans, doing important things. And it just continued to break down those, you know, the stories that I had been told. I was already questioning it because of the classes that I had taken at community college, and having the opportunity to connect with a lot of different types of people and hear their stories. And this was just sort of kind of the nail in the coffin, I guess, spending all of the time like away from like this very intensive Christian culture and beginning to question, like, what does it mean to be a human that is loving or kind or like exhibits the qualities that I think are really important.
Yeah. It was a nail in the coffin to your faith. Is that,
Well, I would say it was, so I don't identify as Christian at this point. And then I think what that realization was, is if the God that I had been raised with was the one that existed, I realized I didn't want anything to do with that God.
Right.
I was like, oh, all the people I care about are going to hell? Oh, that sounds like a great place. I guess I'll just go there. So I continued to like wrestle with this over the years, but that was really the moment where I realized, oh, even if this God, like this definition of God does exist, I want nothing to do with it. I'm not going to play by those rules anymore if that doesn't make sense to me.
I think most of the people listening to this podcast and people who've been on can definitely relate to that. So did that cause friction in your family? I assume your parents were still very devoted to the faith.
Yeah, and they continue to be so. It didn't go over great. We didn't talk about it very much at the time, but the tension was there, and it became apparent. You know, I didn't go very far. Azusa Pacific was 17 miles away from my parents' home. So there was still interaction, and I couldn't necessarily hide from that. We hadn't been people who had like very in-depth emotional conversations about like our process or where we were at any given time. So I could still get away with like talking about the weather at times without like necessarily having to admit to like, how often are you reading your Bible, Amy?
Didn't come up
very often.
So the other aspect that I'm assuming your parents weren't thrilled about would be your identity. Did APU play a role in that, or was that just sort of a foil to all the different ways you were developing as a person?
I would say it happened. I discovered one of my identities, my non-straight sexuality identity at APU. It would have happened elsewhere, but it is funny that it happened there. It was in a sociology class taught by a teacher that was known for riling people up anyways. And she taught us about the Kinsey scale. And it was one of those really beautiful, incredible moments where you see something and you recognize it immediately for the truth. So I had never thought about my sexual identity. And then one day I'm sitting in class and presented with this scale. And I immediately know I'm right in the middle and that there's no chance that I'm straight. And it was just really fascinating to sit there and go, oh, okay, that's who I am. And then that worked out really well in some ways, because just a couple of months later, the Equality Ride came to EPU. So they came on a visit and I was able to sign up as a, I think they had student hosts. And so each one of the Equality Riders was assigned an APU student, and I got to hang out with someone throughout the day. And I got to sort of test some of my assumptions about gay people, which was, are they terrible humans? I literally just hadn't known anybody who was out and gay, and I had newly realized about myself. So I remember spending time with them that day and thinking, oh, wow. These are just nice humans. I don't think that there's anything wrong with them just because they like someone of the same gender. That's really interesting. So I could sort of test that hypothesis, and it didn't really hold up. I didn't know out gay people personally. And actually, it wasn't until maybe I was in high school or even college, my parents didn't tell me one of my uncles is gay, and they had kept that from us. I was practically an adult. I think it was like late high school. And I remember sitting at the table, my parents telling me, I was sitting with my two brothers, and I was the only one that had a reaction. I was like, this does matter. I want to know somebody's sexuality. Why did you keep this from me? And my two brothers were like, whatever, I don't care. But then when I came out, my family had all sorts of feelings about it. So it turns out they do have feelings about queer people. It's just whether or not they're admitting to it at any given time.
So did you eventually meet people at APU? I want to talk about the Soul Force thing in a bit, but like when they all left, when the buses left, and basically the school just sort of sent them on their way with no changes, did you look for people or did you find people?
Yeah, and actually the people who were drawn to connecting with the Equality Riders were the ones in hiding. So I connected with a couple of people through that day where we said in our whispers, or we knew about each other, like, I know what's going on over here. And then after the Equality Ride, I decided I wanted to be a part of their next initiative, which was helping organize protests against Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Mm-hmm. And so I kept in touch with them and was a part of a training so I could do that. And that really, like, putting myself out there while I was not openly out as a queer person, I was openly an ally organizing this protest. And so that is where I've met a lot of the other people who were sort of underground and had these conversations where it would eventually come out that somebody was like, oh yeah, and I also have feelings for somebody of the same gender. But those were the people who were most passionate about what I was doing and helped me do through that process.
Yeah. And so we're going way back before Haven and the GSA. It had to be pretty scary to be being confronted with the reality that there are real repercussions if people find out if you're not straight. Were you ever worried about how either your classmates, your professors, or people would react if they found out?
Yeah, and I try to put myself back in that time and remember. I know that I was hiding a lot of things. Like I already didn't feel as if I was a part of APU. I already knew I was, you know, as a global studies major, as somebody who had gone through LA term, there were stories that were already told about people like me. Like, these are the angry people at APU. Oh, they're the bad kids or whatever. The stories were So I had other people to at least share with in that experience. Like, we were the ones asking questions. We were the ones smoking cigarettes on the curb or whatever. Everybody
on the sidewalk.
They already decided we were going to hell for that. But when I began to sort of engage with my queer identity and try and understand that, I think it didn't really become a point of separation until I met someone. And it was through organizing the sit-in that I got introduced to somebody. And at the time, we both identified as women. And that person was planning on being a youth pastor when they finished at APU. They were still like really committed to that path and really excited about it. And that was when the fear really set in, because before that it was like, I just keep that I'm bisexual to myself and I think about what this could mean. But once you meet somebody, then you're really at risk. And so we hid our relationship from all of our friends, from all of our closest friends for several months. And then it wasn't until we were sort of at a breaking point, because that's so much stress to put on people. And a lot of fear to be holding. So, and the person at the time was like, shit, I need to be a youth pastor. Am I going to lose like my career and all of these things? So I finally reached out to a professor that I really trusted, and who I'd spoken openly with about a few things before. And I invited her over to my apartment, and my partner at the time and I sat down on the couch and told this professor everything, fully expecting for it to be like, yep, sayonara, tough luck, it's over, good luck, you should end this. And she just looked at us and smiled and said, love is love. And I think that was the best thing that could have possibly happened for us.
Yeah, that was very brave of you.
That... I know.
If you're wondering how brave it was for Amy and their partner to come out to that professor, no matter how accepting or inclusive that professor seemed, well, let me tell you. When Soul Force announced it was coming to APU, the faculty had meetings to debate the whole thing. And while most agreed that we should at least be welcoming, per the Bible's instructions for treating travelers, the things said about the quote-unquote gay lifestyle and the quote-unquote gay agenda and gay depravity out loud in a room of educated professors was fucking awful. Many of those who wanted to welcome the visitors made it very clear that they believed being gay was an abomination. And of course, the clatch of old white guys in the cafeteria were incensed out of their pathetic minds that APU was even allowing those abominations onto campus. For the first 5 or 6 years of my 15 years at APU, I tried to give hints that I was affirming, and a precious few students came out to me, though some just admitted they were struggling with their sexuality, believing the deadly myth that their gayness could be cured or prayed away. Every year, there was at least a couple of chapels dedicated to that very fucked up concept, with even a professor giving his testimony that he had beaten gayness with his faith. It was as infuriating as it was heartbreaking. Soul Force was an organization formed in 1998 by Mel White and his husband Gary Nixon to fight against the bigotry and harm against LGBTQ folks by religious people and institutions. The Equality Ride was a program they did for a few years where groups of young folks would go to religious schools and try and dialogue with administration, faculty, and students to try to show love and change hearts and minds. In too many of those schools and institutions, they were threatened with arrest or were just denied entry onto campus. Was there an attempt to like organize back then to, or at least hang out to support each other, like pre-GSA, pre-Haven stuff?
Yeah, and I think it was what had come out of the protest. Because that's all I can really think of is how we had connected, because there was a couple that at the time both identified as men, and they had been a part of the protest for me, with me, and they had actually been the people who went in and applied to be a part of the military and also say they were gay, so they immediately got rejected. So that was the protest, and through that, we had connected with the other sort of queer hiding queer people and allies. And so when I think about it, the best I can remember is it must have been as a result of that, that we were meeting at somebody's apartment off campus. And that's what led to, it was around that time mm-hmm. that the Door of Discussion and the chapel right. protest happened. So I think that's why we were all in touch, or how we had begun to be in touch. And it was that couple who both identified as men at the time. They decided on, it must have just been a few weeks after we were arrested for that Equality Ride, Don't Ask, Don't Tell thing in LA, because it was October 11th, National Coming Out Day. And they said, we're writing our letters, we're coming out, and we're putting yeah. on the Door of Discussion. And it shouldn't have really mattered, because who gave a crap about a yeah. stupid door and like on the side of campus? But people were watching, and they put their letters up, I think, 4 times throughout the day, and they were torn down each time. And the last time, they just removed the door. They just
right. I forgot
pulled
about
it that. Out. And that's why, and I don't know whose idea it was, that's why the chapel protest happened, is we were like, this is outrageous if you can't even say, make a statement about who you are. So it must have been through that group who had been gathering, and we spread the word and did the whole, I think we were in front of 2 different chapel doors, but just like had a little group of people and some duct tape and some signs, but we were like, people have to know about this. This is outrageous. But they were yeah. kicked out of school anyways. They yeah. were never, it didn't necessarily lead to APU was going right. to be APU.
I adopted a saying by halfway through my time there. I was like, well, it's their house. We're the ones disrupting. We're mm-hmm. the ones who don't fit. So did you say you got arrested at the LA protest?
Yeah, so that was a part of the strategic approach of it was Soul Forest yeah. is the name of the organization. So this initiative was across the US, and people organized sit-ins across in all of the different, you know, a bunch of different cities. So the way that it went was you applied with as many people as you could get who were openly queer or willing to be openly queer yeah. and apply to be in the military. And then they would say, I'd like to apply and I'm gay. And so they would, because Don't Ask, Don't Tell was in place, they would have yeah. to say, sorry, we can't
Once
accept
told.
You. And then we just all sat our butts down, and then you just sat. And then you just waited for them to arrest you, because that was just what was going to happen. You're like, we're going to stay here until you accept us. And so the cops would come.
I've said many times in this podcast that nothing changed in the wake of Soul Force's visit to APU. The school made a day of it to host them and have several smaller events and even a chapel service. But I was wrong to say that nothing changed. Things changed in a big way for the school's queer students. For students like Amy, they felt seen, and they saw something they had not seen before. They saw a queer community. The seeds for what would become Haven were planted. As much as the school tried to thread that needle of welcoming the evil visitors and pretending to listen to them before sending them on their way without any harm done to their precious evangelical community, the harm was actually set in motion. The moral arc of evangelicalism does not bend naturally toward anything, but it can be infected from within and forced to bend toward justice. So despite our anger and disappointment at the bad faith welcoming of Soul Force, Amy had a different view. It's hard to think about those times, because the Soul Force, when they came to APU, from my view, all of us who had any interest in faculty and and administration, those of us who expressed interest in wanting to reach out and have dialogue were excluded from the whole thing.
Whoa.
So the school made a big deal about saying, oh, we're, you know, other schools, you know, wouldn't even let them come. We're letting them come and we're going to talk to them. But they were very careful about who they allowed to talk. Everyone who was allowed to speak or lead a discussion, I think, was very well versed in the company line of, okay, well, we're listening because that's what we're supposed to do. But fuck you. We're like, mm-hmm. Nothing's going to change. Nothing's going to, you know, that's it. That's. So were you frustrated? Were you and your friends frustrated after that day of discussion? Because they canceled classes, I think, that day. They canceled to just have this day to welcome Soul Force.
I don't think I was frustrated because I was fucking elated that I had met some gay people.
Oh, yeah, that's great.
Like, that was a really important moment for me, even though I knew it was a bunch of lip service, even though I knew APU wasn't doing anything real. What I had the chance was to connect with a couple of other people at APU who cared about what I cared about, who identified similarly to me. And I got to hang out with people and really demystify all of that crap I'd been taught. So to spend 8 hours with a bunch of awesome queer people was actually, APU lost. Like, I got exactly what I wanted out of that. And I made connections with them. And that really, you know, changed things for me because I already knew who I was. But it gave me a path to connecting with other people like me. So I wouldn't mm-hmm. have to be alone. And I continued on to organize that sit-in, which was a hugely formative experience for me to experience, you know, community organizing and what that looks like. Mm-hmm. And then I went on to be on the next Equality Ride, which was another hugely formative experience.
Were you still a student when you went on the Equality Ride?
Yeah. I actually had to go to the Dean of Students and ask for time off for the Equality Ride while claiming I was an ally.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Right.
So that went, well, they let me go. He wasn't happy. I had spent a lot of time with him because of the door of discussion and all of that. Right. We were already on first name terms. And he had been the person that the couple that who was eventually kicked out had all the conversations with. So we knew each other fairly well by that time. And it's not as if I was out to him, but I went in and said,
right,
hey, this is, and you know, like the thing is, the way I look at it is I was still like really, and in some ways continue to be spiritual in that, like, I felt led, like I felt compelled to be a part of the Equality Ride in 2007. And I felt as if it was my duty to do it. And it felt as if it was a calling bigger than me. And so that language still kind of works within Christian structures. So to say like, hey, this is really where I feel like I need to be. And this is my calling to go on this and I have to go. I mean, he wasn't a jerk. He just didn't believe that queer people were also humans.
Ugh. Okay. So anyway, so how was that experience, the going on the Freedom Ride?
It was not at all what I expected it to be. It was actually a really painful experience. I don't think that I would go back to change it, but I wish I had not approached it so earnestly. To go into those conversations, so the Equality Ride in 2007, there were two buses and I was on the East Coast bus and we went through all of the Midwest down to Baylor in Texas. We went through Mississippi and all the rest of the Southern states. And then we had these conversations. So two outcomes happened when we went to these schools. It was like over the course of 2 months and I think over 20 schools that we went to. And schools would do one of two things. They would do what APU did, which is let you on campus and sort of give you a little bit of lip service, like kind of do a dance and let you talk to five students. Or they would straight up say, you're not allowed on campus and we're going to arrest you if you take a step onto our grass. So either way, we often were able to have conversations with some students if the students came to us out on the street outside of the school. But the majority of the conversations I had, at least the ones that stick with me, were people who were really vehemently against me as a human, who saw my identity as a threat and as an abomination. They like that word. And because I was approaching it so earnestly, that's the part that I regret. Like, I really thought if I showed up with an open heart and shared who I was, that people would want to connect with me. And I just kind of got thrashed again and again, where people were really happy to tell me my relationship that was loving was the equivalent of rape or, you know, attacking cats sexually or so, like really outrageous claims. And that day after day after day, even if I felt like I was okay, you know, it begins to wear away at you if you think the entire world hates your existence.
Even just a few days of that would have been tiring. And you said two months?
It was 2 months.
Oh, man. That sounds awful. I'm sorry you had to go through that. That's just... were there any positive takeaways? Did you meet people that you networked with? Or?
Well, I think we did make a difference because they were the quiet people who came to stand by us and listen to us talking, who just really wanted what I had wanted on that day, was to be close to queer people and just know that it was okay for them to be who they are. So I do think it's really important that we did that work, and they continued to have equality rides for some years after I did it. It really is just that I was in a very tender place, and really wanted to have that conversation and really earnestly believed that, like, oh, if we just approach it open heart to open heart, like, you'll see that we're so similar. But people are really trained to not connect. And they're told, if somebody doesn't believe what you believe, you should shut down.
Yeah. And condemn. And
So there, I value all that I learned on that ride. And I do think there's a lot of really beautiful things that came out of it. My relationships with the other equality riders and seeing how other people negotiated really challenging, you know, experiences. We were in it together. So that is something I'll always have with me. But it is, it was really heavy. And it really let me see that darker, more violent side of Christianity when people don't, not only don't act like the Christ they say they follow, but actively use him as a weapon.
Nothing scares evangelicals more than an idea that challenges their dim, ignorant, vague worldview. It seems like their subconscious recognizes the gaping holes in their views, but their fight or flight kicks in and cuts off any opportunity to actually consider those ideas. We can debate ideas in good faith, but we cannot debate a person's humanity. The image of Amy wanting to engage in honest discussion to connect with Christians, only to be cursed and called names, is heartbreaking. It hurts just thinking about it. I can't imagine what that was like to endure. But this is what we're up against. Conservative Christianity is a real threat to a lot of people. But putting aside our rage against bigoted Christians, it's also important to recognize and celebrate someone like Amy who went through that to help make the world a better place for all of us, even the bigots. They were given a beautiful opportunity to look Amy in the eye and see them as a whole, beautiful person, and they spurned it. To borrow from Jesus' teaching, Amy is a pearl. Those people are swine. They do not deserve them.
Yeah, definitely. And your point about reaching people is well taken, because even the group that came to APU, there was a woman who spoke at with one of the administrators who left a really big impression on a lot of my students. You know, most of my students were freshmen and sophomore, and they were already convinced that, you know, being gay is wrong and evil. But I remember there was like a discussion between one of the administrators and one of the leaders of the ride, where they talked, and she was really effective in making her points, using the Bible and using just Jesus and love to, and I, even though I didn't see it as a big success for APU, definitely seeds were planted. So yeah, I'm sure you did a lot of that in your 2 months, because yeah, how can you not? I mean, you were so earnest in approaching in such good faith to have these discussions. And so,
yeah. And I think, I mean, the importance, I think the really important foundation that SoulForce has, you know, was raised on is the teachings of Martin Luther King and Gandhi. And so it is, mm-hmm. no matter what people are saying to you, no matter what they do to you, you are showing up and essentially showing what people parallel is like the love of Christ, that like you are not going to fight back. And ultimately, if you realize that the people you're talking to are doing more of that than you are, I don't know. I hope that, yeah. I hope that it does make an impression to see that people believe in something so much, and that they're not attacking you back. That means something.
Yeah. Have you kept in touch with a lot of the people from the organization?
Here and there, yeah. There's still
or any of the people, yeah.
Yeah, there's definitely some good folks who are still in my life. Not as often as I'd like, but lots of good people.
Sure. I mean, it's a while ago. I was just wondering, like, you were in the process of deconstructing your faith through that whole time, to the point of, I think you mentioned you are no longer of the faith.
Mm-hmm.
And that just to me seems like a natural process. But I do know there are a lot of people who stay Christian and become pastors and become ministers, or just stay Christian and LGBTQ. So, yeah, I was just wondering if you had any thoughts on the SoulForce crowd. Do a lot of them transfer, keep deconstructing out of faith, or do you think a lot of them stay there?
I think it's a really wide variety of types of people, and some of whom are not, have never been spiritual or have not been raised in that, but love, like, are really dedicated to the work.
Okay.
And dedicated
so not
to
all
understanding.
Of them were...
Mm-mm. No, it
yeah,
was
so
a
not
wide
all
variety.
Of them were Christian identified. Oh, okay.
No, there was a lot of people who had been raised in some version of it. But yeah, not everybody. And we had all sorts of folks in there.
Did you keep up with all of the progress that happened after you left APU? Or were you just sort of like, I need to... Actually, you know, I remember I met you at the first art night.
Yeah, I think...
I don't know if you remember that.
One of my good friends, and I think maybe we were living at Synchronicity then, the co-op house.
Yeah.
One of my friends was still at school after we graduated. And so that, yeah, I was just thinking about that I was invited to one of those art nights. And I think I even read like a spoken word piece at one of them. I don't know if I knew the undertones other than like, oh, this is all the cool people here. I didn't, you know, I don't know if I knew it was specifically like creating a space for the GS, like underground GSA or the safe space.
Yeah, that was by design, just so we could do it on campus.
Mm-hmm.
So you mentioned the Synchronicity House. Do you want to talk about how that came about?
That was through my ex, who is just a very committed person to making things happen. They had this incredible vision and really rallied a bunch of people together after we had all graduated. And we found this enormous old Victorian house in LA, south of Koreatown. It was like 7 bedrooms. And so we were able to fit like 10 or 11 people in there. And it really was like a safe space for, it was a majority of post APU people, to be there and sort of be in whatever state we were. There's, a few of us were queer, and pretty much everybody had deconstructed their beliefs to some extent. And it was a really interesting thing. It's still going, actually. So it has it has continued on. But yeah, it was super interesting to hear in one of the past interviews that that had been a space. Because I remember that conversation. I think Abby out.
Yeah. And Susanna, I think. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay, that's great. That's a nice little tie back there. So what did you think of them? Did you think... you guys, y'all are crazy. Did you think you wanted to help, or were they misguided?
No, I don't think I thought that at all. I think, you know, really at that point in time, I just wanted people to, I don't know. I think I wanted them to understand, you know, the difficulties of what it was to be on campus. And I just thought it was wonderful that people wanted to do that. Mm. 'Cause I started spending as little time on campus as I could once all of my deconstructions and identities sort of came to the forefront. I didn't know how to continue to engage. So for people to try to make it a safer space, I thought was really, really powerful.
That's great. Yeah, I was inspired by them too. I mean, part of me thought they were crazy, just knowing what they were up against. But I knew I had to participate because, I don't know, when you know, you know. It's
mm-hmm.
What I knew when I heard about the GSA being formed by Abby, Susanna, and Matt, and many others, was that if they went through with it, I would be forced to make an active choice. I write about this in painful detail in my book, but the creation of the GSA made me decide if I was really going to do the right thing and participate and support. My teaching career at APU be damned. The school could tolerate social justice, barely, and pretend it didn't notice, but supporting LGBTQ students, first secretly and then openly, would mean, I figured, the end of my time at APU. And I was right. But when I think about the courage of people like Amy and Matt and Abby and Liz and Glenda, the only thing I regret is taking so long to make that decision. Those people gave me the chance to do the right thing, and I want to thank them for that gift.
When you look back at the whole APU thing, and I want to talk about your life now, like, what do you tell people? How do you describe APU and your time there?
I try not to talk about it.
Yeah, that's been a common response.
I generally try not to mention it. Whenever somebody says that they went to a religious school, I become concerned because I know there's a risk that this conversation is going to become concerning. But it is what it is. I am who I am because I walked that path, and I wouldn't trade any of the relationships that I gained through it, but I wouldn't wish it on anybody. So I don't speak highly of it. I just try not to speak of it in general.
Has going back through all this stuff, because I want to talk about at the end sort of who you are now. Thinking about all those times that I'm sure you've worked so hard to remove yourself from. What's that been like to go back through it?
Well, the reality is I never am far from my experiences. I think that my time at APU and the relationships I built and some of those challenges that we faced, that it's really core to who I am. And so it's not, and some of these, the folks are still like my dearest friends who I talk to regularly. So I guess I'm grateful that I have people who understand what it means, that I don't have to explain myself to at least a few people, that they were there and they saw it all happen. So it certainly has been interesting to think, if anything, it was interesting to take the time to try and think about like what order everything happened in. It's like there were so many different experiences. It was such a very intensive time of change for me with all of these different things I was examining. Maybe I could have gone through it somewhere else, but I don't know. It was a lot, but it is a thing that's often on my mind. Maybe that's why I try not to at least name APU, because it's just a huge part. It's all a huge part of who I've become, and I think how I try to hold myself in the world, because I understand how much harm we can cause even if we're not trying.
Oh yeah. Yeah. So how'd you get into food photography?
Well, the rest of my life has been a weird and winding road too. So I got into vegetable farming after several years of like working as a like food pantry manager and stuff in LA. That was all post APU. And then I just really needed to get out of the city. So I started apprenticing as a vegetable apprentice. And I did that for 7 years throughout the US. And then I met my spouse when I was living in New Jersey and managing a farm. And he was coming to Houston, Texas. So I made that leap. And I somehow got into commercial food photography. I think what I love about what I do is I get to, you know, it's not just about food. It's always about the people behind what I'm doing. So whether that's the people who are growing the food or the people who are enjoying it, I love that I get to connect with people and help them tell their stories. So it comes down to a much more like emotionally driven type of work, because that's really where I get my energy.
Yeah, it's all that you just said is apparent just following your Instagram account.
Good, I'm doing the right, yeah, I'm doing the right
doing,
thing then.
Doing good. Makes me want to go down to the farmer's market. So cool. Thank you for taking the time to talk, because I know you're very busy, and this is not easy stuff to talk about, so.
Yeah, well, I appreciate you. I think this is a conversation that, you know, my hope is that if people are listening to this that are still in those spaces, that they can feel like they're not alone, and they can know that there are other people out there like them, and that it's going to be okay, because there's certainly a lot of times when you're not sure if you're in the middle of it.
We can trace the rise of LGBTQ identity and activism from those days of Amy's time at APU during the W. Bush era all the way to the end when the school took over in the mid-2010s. From Amy's community formed in the wake of the SoulForce visit, to Abby and Liz's work to make safe spaces on campus, to Glenda's era of confronting the school on a national stage, two things are clear to me as someone who was there for almost all of that. The students who had to fight for their dignity and their safety in the face of horrible bigotry are all heroes to me. I'm inspired by them, and you know, I'm inspired to keep fighting and finding ways to love people. And secondly, evangelical culture is toxic sludge to all things outside of conservative, fundamentalist, white nationalism. Even when it tries to help those on the margins, whether LGBTQ communities, BIPOC communities, or even women in general, it destroys the inherent integrity, dignity, agency, and self-worth. This has been the message all along on Chapel Probation. We tell these stories not just to target a place like APU. It's much bigger than that. APU just happens to be where we experienced what all marginalized people experience in evangelical culture. We are reminded every day, we were reminded every day, that we were less than our white classmates and colleagues, even as we attempted to fit into their culture. APU is just one room of the evangelical house. And even though it touts itself as an academic institution, it is, and always has been, more Sunday school than university school. It is what it is, but we want the world to know. It fucking sucks for any self-actualized person, including white people, to go there. And in red states like Florida and Texas, and many others, evangelicals have made life dangerous for LGBTQ people. There is a direct line between the bigotry faced at APU and the dangers from evangelical politicians in red states and blue states, for that matter. The dangers are real. The world is a dangerous place for all marginalized people, where evangelicals hold sway in life and politics. This would be true with or without APU existing, but it definitely exists at APU and all evangelical schools and all evangelical spaces. Okay, so this is the end of season one. Thank you so much for listening to our stories. My book is filled with many more like them, focusing on my own development as a Japanese American man and my deconstruction from Christianity altogether. I just want to thank you all again for tuning in and listening to the Chapel Probation podcast. It has been a privilege to talk to everyone who's come on, and even everyone in the Facebook group and on Instagram and Twitter who have messaged me. I didn't realize how important it would be to tell these stories, but from the response, I feel like this podcast has played a small part in people's healing and moving on from evangelical culture and from places like APU. There are so many more stories to tell, and I hope to continue to do so after I finish my book. So, hope to see you in season two of Chapel Probation, you reprobates.
This episode was brought to you by Evangelicalism. Yeah, this episode's, this whole podcast brought to you by, yeah, reprobates.